might have been asleep. Did you mention that? That's fine. You should have got maybe one of these pancake party invitations that you can pass on to somebody else. We've had a pancake party, 5 or 6 years, I should think, probably by now. If you've never experienced the pancake party, you're missing out. You're missing the complete craziness of the pancake party. But what we do is we put up some tables at the front and we get some camping stoves and we cook pancakes in here for about 2 hours, really, until the mixture all runs out. And we have tables laid up here at the front for people to put their fillings in, some savoury, some sweet. Well, the kids tend to eat the sweet stuff anyway. So you can try a variety of flavours with your pancake. And the room is normally pretty packed, so normally we have about 80 people come and have pancakes with us. And Helen normally does some games and things. So it's a really, really good riot anyway. If you'd like to come, you're very welcome. If you were to push me and say yes, it is something we design for families. So if there are particular families that you want to invite, neighbours, friends, whatever, your own family, that's okay too, then bring it along. But Shrove Tuesday is Tuesday the 28th this year. Okay, that's at the end of the month. Ah, yes. If you'd like to help, either on the day, cooking, and whatever else, or if you'd like to cook pancakes, or if you can make bowls of batter, bring in a bowl of batter that we can use to cook, all of that is fantastic. So please talk to Helen. Because she's very lonely. No, she's not. But Helen will help you out. Right, we are carrying on, like Gary said, our series from Numbers, and we're in Numbers chapter 16 today. This is the sixth of seven talks from Numbers. You might have missed what we've been doing so far, so just as a little roundup, we are following some of the story of what happens after the people of Israel leave Egypt. That's the time when, about 1500 years BC, they were in slavery and God got them out with the Passover and with the Red Sea parting, bringing the people across, and all the Egyptians drowned. And they got into the desert and then God gave them the law at Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments and all the rest. A lot more than Ten Commandments in the end. But they received all this and the instructions about how to make a tabernacle, a place of worship, a tent where God's presence would dwell among them. And then they were to head to the Promised Land, and they were supposed to enter the Promised Land. And last week what we saw instead was the people going, yeah, it's nice, but we're a bit scared, so we won't do that. We'll run away instead. And so that's what they did. And God said, okay, if you're not going into the Promised Land, you're going to spend the next 40 years wandering this desert until all of you lot have died out. Well, apart from Joshua and Caleb, because they were the only two who thought we should go into the land. So this follows on from that, and the trouble's not over, really, for the people. And so today we're looking at we'll read the story now. It's inside your welcome sheet here, but generally referred to as Korah's rebellion. So one day, this guy Korah, son of Izhar, a descendant of Kohath, son of Levi, conspired with Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, from the tribe of Reuben. They incited a rebellion against Moses, along with 250 other leaders of the community, all prominent members of the assembly. They united against Moses and Aaron and said, "You've gone too far. The whole community of Israel has been set apart by the Lord, and he's with all of us. What right do you have to act as though you're greater than the rest of the Lord's people?" When Moses heard what they were saying, he fell face down on the ground. Then he said to Korah and his followers, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show us who belongs to him and who's holy. The Lord will allow only those whom he selects to enter his own presence. Korah, you and all your followers must prepare your incense burners. Light fires in them tomorrow and burn incense before the Lord. Then we'll see whom the Lord chooses as his holy one. You Levites are the ones who've gone too far. The Lord is the one you and your followers are really revolting against. For who is Aaron that you're complaining about him? Then Moses summoned Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but they replied, "We refuse to come before you. Isn't it enough that you brought us out of Egypt, a land flowing with milk and honey, to kill us here in this wilderness, and that you now treat us like your subjects? What's more, you haven't brought us into another land flowing with milk and honey. You haven't given us a new homeland with fields and vineyards. You're trying to fool these men. We won't come." So each of those men prepared an incense burner, lit the fire and placed incense on it, and all stood at the temple entrance of the tabernacle, along with Moses and Aaron. And the Lord said to Moses, "And tell all the people to get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." And Moses says, "This is how you know that the Lord has sent me to do all these things that I've done, for I haven't done them on my own. If these men die a natural death, or if anything unusual happens, the Lord hasn't sent me. But the Lord does something entirely new, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them and all their belongings, and they go down alive into the grave, then you'll know that these men have shown contempt for the Lord." He'd hardly finished speaking the words when the ground suddenly split open beneath them. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed the men, along with their households and all their followers who were standing with them, and everything they owned. So they went down alive into the grave, along with all their belongings. And the earth closed over them. They all vanished from among the people of Israel. All the people around them fled when they heard their screams. "The earth will swallow us up too," they cried. Then fire blazed forth from the Lord and burned up the 250 men who were offering incense. It's quite some story, isn't it? I've had to cut it down a bit again, as I have done in previous weeks, because it's quite a long story if I gave you all the detail. There's more that Moses says. But basically, that idea that people are objecting, Moses has this way forward that involves his incense burners, the 250 leaders, and in the end, some of them disappear into the ground, and others, fire comes out from God and burns them. So it's quite horrific in that sense. It's not short of drama, is it? I thought I'd start off by talking about rebellious youth. Of course, naturally. I don't know if you had a rebellious youth growing up. Mine was non-existent, really. One of the people I think about when I think about rebellious youth is Helen's dad, actually, who was brought up in a very Christian home, but his parents, I guess, were quite strict, you would say. And so Helen's dad rebelled because he started smoking when he was, what, in his teens? Younger than in his teens, he started smoking, and he smoked for his whole life. Helen's grandma, so her dad's mum, she was, just to show you how strict she was, there was somebody in the family got married, and she heard there was dancing at the wedding, and she blamed it on the fact that the bride was brethren. That was her reason. So if that means anything to you. For myself, I kind of rebelled by not being rebellious. My parents would say things to me like, "Why don't you dye your hair green over the summer holidays?" And I'd say, "No." So that was my rebellion. I do remember, however, I did have a pair of fluorescent pink socks that occasionally I dared to wear under my school uniform, which was, you know, black, basically. So if you caught a glimpse of my socks, you would undoubtedly notice them. That was it. That was rebellion for me. Not very exciting, really. There we go. Rebellion's been in the news this week with this guy, Jeremy Corbyn, and the Labour vote over Brexit. You've probably seen that. about how 50 of his 200 odd MPs, maybe more than that, voted against a bill where he said we have to vote for it because of the result of the referendum. So that was described as rebellion. And in the end, what he did was he tried to play down that by talking about this as just a difference of opinion, you know, and how this was their right as MPs to represent their constituents in a particular way and so on and so on. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. As well, when I think about rebellion and youth, there was an old James Dean film, wasn't there? Rebel Without a Cause. It's probably one of those great pieces of cinema that I've not seen. But here he is, James Dean, being a rebel without a cause. And in those days, probably that was a big thing, you know, when that film came out. Here is a guy who just goes around rebelling for the sake of it. There's no cause to it, he just does it for the sake of it. Because he's growing up. Because he doesn't want to be shackled by all the rules of his parents and so on. Do you? Well, it's a good question. Okay, so there's something good about rebellion where it helps us to think about the values that lies behind those things and to say, actually, is it the best thing just to go along with everything? So maybe there's something helpful in that. Pretty much, yeah. I did, actually. But the thing I was going to say about teenage rebellion now is that we don't really see it as anything other than normal teenage behaviour. I think there would have been a time where, clearly with James Dean, you know, here's something out of the ordinary. Here's a guy who's rebelling for no reason. Well, now it's just normal behaviour. No one thinks about, you know, if a teenager smokes a cigarette, that's not rebellion, that's just being normal, isn't it? And so we kind of normalise that whole thing. Our kind of liberal society, where we have so many freedoms, means that this idea of rebellion is almost lost, because there's nothing left to rebel against. So I wonder then, when you look back on your teenage years, maybe like Sue, and you think about what you did, whether you rebelled, does it make you laugh? Does it make you cry, maybe, in some bits? Does you just think, oh, that's so stupid? And actually, perhaps some of the stuff you've done has had some other knock-on effects. Actually, it's really affected the relationship that you've got with your brother or your parent or whoever it is. But rebellion is a thing. It's basically this business, isn't it, of defying authority. It doesn't matter whether it's your parents. It doesn't matter whether it's school rules. It doesn't matter whether it's Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. It doesn't matter whether it's law enforcement. And actually, kind of, we live partly with this constant sense of rebelling, that we still find that exciting to break the rules where we can. You know, one of the elders in the church where I grew up, he loved hot hatchbacks. He loved fast cars. And so, you know, if he came to... There was one time he came to visit us. My folks, they lived at the bottom of a close at the time, and my mum was convinced that he'd reached 50 by the time he got halfway up the road, you know, because he loved doing that. That was his bit of rebellion. Didn't get over it. But we do, we break social conventions, you know, that's a rebellion. We ignore good advice from our doctors about our diet and our health. We ignore good advice about our finances. Oh, it doesn't matter. I'll just go and I'll spend that money. I know I don't have it, but it doesn't matter. I'll just go and spend it. And someone else says, well, why did you do that? So what does God say about rebellion? Well, we see some of it in the story we're looking at this morning. You know, over the last few weeks, we've witnessed the people with all their whining and their fear. And today we see them in all-out rebellion against their leaders, Moses and Aaron. And so we're going to see what kind of message we've got here for us today. The peasants are revolting. That's one of those old jokes, isn't it? But it's kind of, it probably comes from one of the Carry On films or something, I should imagine. But this kind of idea, that's Les Mis and the revolution in France and so on. The idea of revolting against leadership. And here in the story, what we've got is 250 community leaders, led by this guy Cora and three others. And they incite a rebellion. That's what it says in verse 2, incite a rebellion. Literally, it means they rose up. And you can kind of imagine that, if Gary didn't like the way I was talking to him, he might get out of his chair and stand up to face off at me, If he wanted to really show that he was standing up to me, that's what he would do. And so they kind of rise up. And they have this complaint in verse 3. They say, "You've gone too far. The whole community has been set apart by the Lord. He's with all of us. What right do you have to act as though you're greater than the rest of us?" It's a rebellion against Moses' authority. And if you look down at verses 13 and 14, which is about in the middle of the page there, there's something really revealing in the words that these guys, Dathan and Abiram, say. They say, effectively, "It's you. You're the one who brought us out of Egypt. Egypt was this wonderful place for us. It was just flowing with milk and honey. And you brought us out." And they say, "And you've led us here, and we're now dying in the desert, and it's your fault. And you lord it over us, you do. You throw your weight around. You treat us like your royal subjects. And then, what's worse, is that you haven't led us into this other place you said you were going to. You promised us fields, you promised us vineyards, you promised us all this milk and honey in this new place, and you've not done any of that." And then they say, "Are you trying to fool these men?" Literally it says, "Are you trying to put out their eyes?" They have this suspicion that when people come up to Moses, he's going to go poke, and he's going to put their eyes out. But he's not serious at all in talking to them. That's revealing because none of it is true. None of it's true, actually. We've got such short memories, they can't even remember what we looked at last week. And they lived through it. But if the people themselves decide they aren't going to go into that promised land flowing with milk and honey with all the fields and all the vineyards. There's not a single word in all of that that's true. It's not the first time either for Moses that he's been opposed. Just a few chapters back in chapter 12, Aaron himself, who's Moses' brother, and Miriam, who's Moses' sister, they come and they challenge Moses. And one of the things that God says in that instance is, Moses is a humble man. In fact, the Bible says more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. Moses is not the man that lords it over people. And actually, you can see that here. You see where they talk about, they say, "What right do you have to act as you do, as if you're greater than the rest of us?" And when Moses hears what he's saying, he falls face down on the ground. That's a sign of humility. That's like bowing as low as you can possibly bow. In front of somebody great? No, in front of the people who are accusing him. That's a sign of humility. He's not doing that before God, he's doing it before them. There's some interesting words as well in verse 19, which is one of those verses that I glossed over. It says that Korah, this rebellion, they'd stirred up the whole community And so this business that starts off with Korah and a couple of others, and then there's 250 guys, it spreads to the rest of the community. And so actually it goes on, God goes on to say that he's ready to wipe them all out and start again with Moses. Just like he did with Abraham. And here again, here's Moses being humble, because what he does is he defends them as a people. He said, don't do that, God. Must you be angry with all the people when only one man sins? That's a humble guy, in my opinion. So Moses is quite right then, when he interprets this rebellion as revolt against the Lord. He says it in verse 11, the Lord is the one you and your followers are really revolting against. He says it again in verse 30. He says that you have shown contempt for the Lord. And the Bible itself then is unafraid to attribute the fate of these 250 odd guys and their families to God. That this isn't Moses' doing, this is God's doing. This is God's justice. And that therefore, whatever right Moses has to leave, it doesn't come from Moses. It doesn't come from Moses throwing his weight around, saying, I'm the leader, you do what I say. It comes from the Lord. That God's right to take those people's lives, because he's the judge of all the earth. That in opposing Moses, they're opposing God. And God is God. And who on earth are you? God is jealous for his glory. And that means that you do his will, not the other way round. So Moses says, therefore, in verse 28, he says, that the fate that's going to befall these people is how you'll know the Lord has sent him. The way that God responds to these other 250 people, these ones that are opposing him, that shows that God is behind Moses. That Moses is doing what God wants. That Moses has not and cannot do anything on his own. Can he get them out of Egypt? Did Moses sweet talk Pharaoh into letting the people go? No. There was plague after plague after plague after plague. And then Pharaoh lost his own son, and that was the point at which Pharaoh said, go. Moses didn't make those things happen, God did them. Moses can't make the ground open up and swallow these folk. Moses can't make fire come out from the presence of the Lord. And yet, verse 41, which follows on from where what I read here, what happens when the people witness what happens to these 250? Do they go, oh my goodness, we've done the wrong thing here? No, they say, Moses, it's your fault they died. You're killing the Lord's people. And so another plague breaks out, whatever form, I don't know. But it says that a further, get this, 14,700 people die in this incident. It's notorious, effectively. And the dying only stops again because of Moses. Because he sends Aaron out into the middle of the people to stand between the dead and the living, like a barrier, so that no one else has to die. So that's extraordinary, isn't it? I think that story gives us a real picture of what kind of a leader Moses was. Surprisingly, this story about Korah's rebellion, it does get mentioned in the New Testament. Only once, I'll give you that. Only once, but it is mentioned. In the book of Jude, in that's the song line. Jude is one of the shortest books in the Bible. In fact, it's second to last in the whole Bible. Jude was one of the brothers of Jesus. But he has some really strong things to say. And to say about leaders. And to be honest, the Beatles might want to say, "Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take your sad song, make it better. You know? Don't be so strong on all this." But here's what Jude says, and this is only some of it. He says, "I want to remind you that Jesus first rescued the whole nation of Israel from Egypt, but he later destroyed those who didn't remain faithful. In the same way, these people, these folk I'm about to talk about, live immoral lives, defy authority and scoff at supernatural beings. What sorrow awaits them? For they follow in the footsteps of Cain, who killed his brother. Like Balaam, they deceive people for money. And like Korah, they perish in their rebellion." Who are these folk he's talking about? They're people he called shameless shepherds. Shameless shepherds. People who live immoral lives and defy authority. Shameless shepherds. People who had influence within the church. They were teaching people, but they were teaching them to do that, to live immoral lives and defy authority. And Jude, I said he doesn't, he's got some strong things to say. He says the fate of folk like that, these shameless shepherds, he says they're going to be doomed to blackest darkness, which is, you know, very much kind of the fate of Korah and the guys in this story. It's all kind of fire and brimstone stuff, isn't it? It's all very bold, very strong. What's the problem exactly with all of this? When you see that word rebellion, it's this Greek word, antilogia. Alright? Antilogia. Jude talks about these people defying authority. Jude talks about them denying our only Lord and Master, Jesus Christ. I've got two aunties. I've got Auntie Sue and Auntie Linda. But Auntie Logia is not the kind of person that you want to have as your auntie, right? I'll say auntie, I'll pretend I'm from the north, I don't really. Good lad. Auntie Logia. Right? Auntie Logia sounds really sweet in your ears, but she tells you you're right when you're wrong. And what she does is she makes you believe twisted truth. Let me just show you this. Do you remember the argument over this? Fake news. Question, how big was the crowd at Trump's inauguration? Asked Trump and his advisors. It was the biggest crowd ever. That's Trump, that's Obama in 2009. You can see the difference. Now, it might be that that was taken about 4 hours before the thing started and that took place right in the middle of it. I don't know, actually. I can't tell you that. But there was this big argument over fake news, wasn't there? And this word, antilogia, basically is the equivalent of fake news. It's taking something and twisting it and making it untrue. And Korah does that in his rebellion. He says, Egypt, it flowed with milk and honey. No, it didn't. It flowed with dead bodies because the Egyptians beat them to death. He says, Moses lords it over us. No, he doesn't. When has he ever done that? In fact, there's a point where he says, Lord, I've not even taken a donkey from these people. Effectively, I haven't even got somebody to carry my bags for me. He doesn't lord it over anyone. Pharaoh did. He wanted them to make bricks till they were blue in the face and drop down dead. Or to build his wonderful empire and capital and everything else. Pharaoh lorded it over them. But Korah's got this idea this anti-logia, this bit of fake news, that Egypt was a land flowing with milk and honey, and it wasn't. And in Jude, it's just the same. The message of these shameless shepherds, the fake news is, God is so gracious. Isn't God gracious, everyone? Yes, he is. That means you can be as immoral as you like. No, that's fake news. That's not true. So I wonder if you've got an anti-logia. I wonder if you've got a... She's been telling you, if you like, some lie inside your head that you've been believing all this time. It could be... You don't really have to listen to Jesus. You can live your life your own way. It could be... You're not a bad person. God will just forgive you anyway. It might be... You were right to do that. They really deserved it. It might be... Everybody does what you do. They just hide it a bit better. I was either listening to or reading about somebody's story this week where... They thought that like that everybody took drugs just like they did. They thought that was the case. It's not the case. I can quite assure them it's not the case. But it's fake news. And it affects the way that we live and we stand before God. So did Jesus rebel? I don't know if you can quite see that, but it's kind of a takeoff of that picture of Che Guevara that, you know, card-carrying socialists like to wear. You know, it's a sign of rebellion to have Che Guevara on your t-shirt. Did Jesus rebel? Well, he certainly didn't toe the party line. He was often in conflict, wasn't he, with the existing religious leaders. The scribes, who were the experts in religious law, the Pharisees, who were the religious bigwigs, really, the sticklers for detail. And Jesus came along and he criticised all their traditions. He called them blind guides. And in his whole ministry then what he did was he changed that view of God from one where God expects us to jump through hoops to keep him happy, to a God who is full of loving generosity, who is merciful and not merciless. And so what Jesus did was he defended his disciples for eating without washing their hands first. Can you imagine that? Eating without washing your hands first? It's a real trial getting our kids to wash their hands before meals. But is it the end of the world? He defended his disciples for picking grain off the stems to eat raw on the Sabbath, because as far as the Pharisees were concerned, that was harvesting and that's work. You're not allowed to work on the Sabbath. Jesus healed a guy with a deformed hand on the Sabbath. He touched people with infectious diseases. He touched dead bodies, even. You do not do this. This is not the way that God expects you to behave. The law is very clear on that. And he even allowed a woman who was caught having an affair to walk away scot-free, telling her just to go and sin no more. But just like with Korah, they wouldn't accept his authority. People refused to accept Jesus' words. So Jesus ends up saying things like this. Why do you call it blasphemy when I say I'm the Son of God? After all, the Father set me apart and sent me into the world. Don't believe me unless I carry out my Father's work. But if I do his work, believe in the evidence of the miracles that I've done. Even if you don't believe me. Effectively, he's saying the same thing Moses said, that this is how you know if the Lord has sent me. This will happen. That will happen. You might find what I'm saying hard, Jesus is saying, but if I do all these miracles and it's all wonderful, and God's clearly in it, do you think he's behind me or against me? But the Pharisees and the scribes said, well, he's not the prophet we want. And the Jewish people said, well, he's not the freedom fighter that we want. And the Romans said, well, he's not a ruler that we can respect. And the Greeks said, well, this isn't a philosophy that we can abide by. And so they crucified Jesus. Because they didn't want him, they didn't need him, they didn't respect him, and they wouldn't listen to him. But unlike Moses, whom God justified by the deaths of others, God justified Jesus by raising him from the dead. And so in all of this, Jesus wasn't the rebel. They were the rebels. And like Moses, Jesus was God's mouthpiece. It was God's authority they defied when they wouldn't listen to Jesus. And they failed to learn lessons from the story of Korah. Like Gary said earlier on Wednesday, we've got Tony's funeral. If you didn't know Tony, Tony was a guy with a learning disability. He was here at our church for 7 years. He'd been in another church across town before that. And on Wednesday then we'll be celebrating his life and his love for Jesus. His passing is really sad. He's gone from this world. But like Gary said, now he's with Jesus in his kingdom for eternity. Because he loved Jesus. Because he listened to Jesus. Because he said, Jesus is my Lord. And everyone who loves Jesus like Tony loved Jesus will share Tony's future with Jesus in his kingdom. Isn't that great news? But there's always two sides to the coin. For those who don't love Jesus, those who reject Jesus, are rejecting that future with Jesus as well. And so we kind of face this question, you know? Are we like the people that said, we don't want, we don't need, we don't respect, we won't heed Jesus? Are you like Korah? Are you the one saying to Jesus, what right do you have to dictate anything to me? And the warning is from the story of Korah that if you show contempt for the Lord, you'll share Korah's fate. The Bible compares humanity to like wandering sheep. That we're all like wandering sheep. We're all rebels. We all go astray. We all do our own thing. But God, being this great shepherd, wants to bring us back. And so the reason that he sent his son from heaven was to lead us home. To him. No one else knows the way apart from Jesus. Because he's the son. And the choice for us is whether to listen to Jesus or whether to keep wandering. You might say to me at this point, you know, what right do you have to talk like that? What right do you have to stand up on that platform? None. I have no right. I have no right to stand here. I didn't earn this. I don't own this. This is my privilege. And my privilege is to pass on Jesus' words. Because I end up being one of Jude's shameless shepherds if I don't pass on what Jesus actually said and taught. If I twist it, if I come up with my own fake news. So I don't set myself above anyone. I'm not here to lord it over anyone. I'm a wandering sheep that Jesus is now leading home. That's all I can say for myself. The only difference, potentially, between me and you today could be that I've listened to Jesus, I've turned and I'm following him home, and you haven't. So I wonder if that's something you need to do today. If so, then talk to me about it afterwards. Perhaps I could just throw one more thing in before I finish. Just picking up, I'd forgotten until you said it, that my theme for all these talks was moving on. Now, in terms of leadership and moving on, you know, it's my privilege to be one of the leaders here. And I expect leadership to be a dialogue between the leader and everyone else in church. I'm not a dictator. I don't lord it over us. I don't say, this is what we're doing, so live with it. But if Korah had approached Moses with dialogue, not with accusation, things would have turned out differently, wouldn't they? So however we go on as a church together, in all the times that you are likely to disagree with me, church, let's do it right, yeah? Let's not go the same way as Korah.